Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, January 7th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks, as evidenced by my soft-collared shirt. Joining us on the program today, contributing editor to the New Republic, author of the upcoming book, The Right People, Osita Wanevu will be joining us. Also on the program today, Judy Gold shall be here. Also on the program today, Supreme Court hears vaccine mandate cases. I believe as we speak, maybe they've taken a quick break. Unemployment down to 3.9%, but that's pre-Omicron. Republicans run away from the ceremony yesterday to honor those who protected them on January 6th. New infections top 600,000 daily, as hospitalizations are set to hit a new peak. U.S. Postal Service prepares to send 500,000 COVID tests from the government to the people for free. Canada bans gay conversion therapy. And sorry, not sorry, Oregon, you will not have Nick Kristof become your governor. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Friday. Emma Vigeland enjoying her final day of vacation. That is, of course, until she comes back with COVID and then has to... I shouldn't say that. She does not have COVID, but she'll be testing, and then we'll see. Hopefully she'll come back Monday or Tuesday. We shall see. Knock on wood. On the IM, left-handed stranger says, what's the deal with him always mentioning his soft-collared shirt? I assume the him is me. I don't know why they are addressing it as if they're talking to somebody else. But on Fridays, it's Casual Friday. And so I no longer wear the stiff collared shirt that I normally wear, and I wear a soft collared shirt. Now, if you want to be picky, you could look at my other collared shirts and say, like, they don't look that stiff, but it's just, I don't know. That's what we do around here.
It's a little treat for Sam, and verbalizing it makes it even feel more special.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you. It's nice to be like seen for once. The Supreme Court is hearing arguments right now on two different cases. They both deal with so-called vaccine mandates. And I say so-called because one of them is not really a vaccine mandate. And actually, Sonia Sotomayor made this point just moments ago, I think. We will get to the audio from Elena Kagan later, but I just want to have people to have an understanding of what's going on here. There are two cases. One is, I believe, Biden versus Missouri. The other one is the NFIB versus the Department of Labor. I believe in that second case, the Solicitor General of Ohio is not going to be in attendance today. They are remote because they have COVID. The Biden versus Missouri deals with a federal rule that requires virtually all healthcare workers to become vaccinated. That is a vaccine mandate. But to be clear, it's a mandate of vaccine of healthcare workers in hospitals and places that accept Medicare and Medicaid. In other words, your Medicare and Medicaid funding is tied to a requirement that all of your people who are working there are vaccinated. Now, that constitutes virtually nearly all healthcare workers. But understand that's the dynamic there. The second is workers at companies with 100 or more employees. It's not a vaccine mandate. They either have to get vaccinated or be regularly tested for COVID-19. And so, in other words, it's a testing mandate where if you are vaccinated, you are exempt from that mandate. So it's not the government is not forcing everyone to, you know, inject something into their body that will obviously give them better reception with their cell phones. No, it's either saying you take the better reception with your cell phones or you get tested. Or in other words, you get tested, and if you happen to have the better cell phone reception from the vaccination, then you don't need to get tested. So this is not a vaccine mandate. It's a testing mandate. The government can get their hands out of my nostrils. Those are the issues at hand right now. The bigger issues are ones that are sort of maybe not even tangential to ones that we've been talking about on this program, which is the ability of federal agencies to get broad instructions from Congress, OSHA in one instance, that's the NFIB versus Department of Labor case, OSHA, which under an act from, I don't know, 50 years ago, has a mandate to make sure that workplaces are safe for workers. This is obviously extraordinary circumstances. We've had over 800,000 people die of this disease. We have hospitals at peak, if not today, within days, there's going to be peak hospitalizations for COVID. Now, to be fair, a lot of those are people who happen to have COVID and are in the hospitals. But a certain percentage of them are also people who have or are there because of COVID. And the bottom line is, at one point, the hospitals just break. And the question is whether or not the Supreme Court will allow Congress to issue a broad mandate to these executive agencies for them to carry out those broad mandates. Or will the Supreme Court decide that they know better? That's the big question that we're seeing in this. And whether a president who has been elected by the United States population has the ability through its agencies to issue arguably mandates based upon the payments of Medicare and Medicaid to these hospitals so that hospital workers will keep Americans safe. We allow the president to attack other countries because of national security, right? Ostensibly. Fight them over there so we don't fight them over here. We allow presidents to do all sorts of different things that are ostensibly in the best interests of the country. And if the president doesn't have the ability to do this when 800, 900,000 people, it's going to end up being a million, it's going to be more, are dying from a pandemic. It's hard to imagine what a president can do to protect the American people. But the Supreme Court, of course, can step in and say you can't do that because of the non-delegation principle that we have made up. And so that's where we're at today. We'll play a clip from Elena Kagan, who really, I think, reacted to this suit, these two different suits, with the sort of drippy, you know, in between the lines disdain that you really should. It also brings up, you know, a good point about the sort of the nature of our democracy that Osita has written about in the New York Times. And I think his book is also sort of around that as well. We'll talk about that in a moment. But this is pretty stunning. Years ago on Break Room Live, I remember we did a sort of a parody of a phone call that a congressman from Georgia called in to apologize to Rush Limbaugh. And it was sort of a parody insofar as like we just went a little further than the congressman did, but it was really embarrassing for the congressman. But you couldn't see his face. It was just a call in because Limbaugh was a radio show at that, you know, exclusively. And in fact, I think it was always. But this clip of Ted Cruz going on Tucker Carlson last night and begging for Tucker Carlson's forgiveness for having used the wrong word in describing something is pretty rich. Now, to be fair, you as an audience will have to determine, is Ted Cruz debasing himself more in this clip, or did he debase himself more when Donald Trump said his wife was ugly and he said, I won't. I can't remember. He was like looking into the camera going like, I from Texas and we don't take that kind of thing from Donald Trump. And then like 2 weeks later was like, I think he's going to be the best president ever. Here is Ted Cruz.
Last time we were surprised by it. We prefaced it by saying every conservative appreciates Ted Cruz because he's one of the smartest and most articulate people in the Congress, and he's conservative. But he referred publicly to what happened on January 6th as, quote, a violent terror attack. Here it is.
We are approaching a solemn anniversary this week, and it is an anniversary of a violent terrorist attack on the Capitol where we saw the men and women of law enforcement demonstrate incredible courage, incredible bravery, risk their lives to defend the men and women who serve in this Capitol.
Senator Cruz was game enough to come on tonight. We appreciate that. He joins us now. Senator, thanks so much for coming on. So I guess what I mean, there are a lot of dumb people in the Congress. You're not one of them. I think you're smarter than I am. And you never use words carelessly. And yet you called this a terror attack when by no definition was it a terror attack. That's a lie. You told that lie on purpose, and I'm wondering why you did.
Well, Tucker, thank you for having me on. When you aired your episode last night, I sent you a text shortly thereafter and said, listen, I'd like to go on because the way I phrased things yesterday, it was sloppy and it was frankly dumb. And
I don't buy that. Whoa, 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 whoa. For, look, I've known you a long time since before you went to the Senate. You're a Supreme Court contender. You take words as seriously as any man who's ever served in the Senate. And every word you repeated that phrase, I do not believe that you used that accidentally. I just don't.
So, Tucker, as a result of my sloppy phrasing, it's caused a lot of people to miss.
Oh, Tucker. Please believe me, Tucker. I was sloppy. Oh, my God. This is so sad. Is there more?
Well, there's a lot more.
Yeah, let's keep going a little bit more. This is really just sort of so embarrassing. It's funny.
Understand what I meant. Let me tell you what I meant to say. What I was referring to are the limited number of people who engaged in violent attacks against police officers. Now, I think you and I both agree that if you assault a police officer, you should go to jail. That's who I was talking about. And the reason the phrasing was sloppy is I have talked dozens, if not hundreds of times. I've drawn a distinction I wasn't saying that the thousands of peaceful protesters supporting Donald Trump are somehow terrorists. I wasn't saying the millions of patriots across the country supporting President Trump are terrorists. And that's what a lot of people have misunderstood
that comment. Wait a second, hold on. What you just said doesn't make sense. So if somebody assaults a cop, he should be charged and go to jail. I couldn't agree more. We have said that for years. But that person's still not a terrorist. How many people have been charged with terrorism on January 6th? Like, why'd you use that word? You're playing into the other side's...
Pause it for 1 second. Now, I don't know how much Tucker makes. Millions of dollars. Presumably, there are people around Tucker who make hundreds of thousands of dollars. This question is actually knowable. How many people were charged with terrorism? I think there was actually like dozens upon dozens who were charged with domestic terrorism for this. Now, one could argue whether they should have been or not. I mean,
but don't pose that question.
Don't pose that question as if you can't find the answer. You can find the answer. There were dozens of, it was maybe over 100. Now, I might agree that domestic terrorism laws are poorly written. Although, you know, I mean, what is terrorism, right? Acts of violence to impact a political outcome. I wouldn't necessarily that, but certainly we know how many people were charged with terrorism. Just play this a little bit more because it's so fun to watch Tucker make Ted Cruz squirm like this.
Characterization that, as Joe Kent just explained, allows them to define an entire population as foreign combatants. And you know that. So why'd you do it?
So Tucker, let me answer you directly. The reason I use that word, for a decade, I have referred to people who violently assault police officers as terrorists. I've done so over and over and over again. If you look at all the assaults we've seen across the country, I've called that terrorism over and over again. That being said, Tucker, I agree with you. It was a mistake to say that yesterday. And the reason is what you just said, which is we've now had a year of Democrats in the media twisting words and trying to say that all
we're done. Now, will you play the clips of how many times Tucker criticized Ted Cruz for calling people who got into fights with the police as domestic terrorists?
I was just trying to be consistent when I was demonizing BLM as terrorists, but I understand that consistency is not what we're after here.
Exactly. And of course, Tucker himself never criticized Ted Cruz for calling anybody a terrorist before, ever, probably in the history of his entire show and maybe in the history of his entire television career, which has been about 22 years. So, I don't know. That's that was fun to watch. Folks, now a word from our sponsor, one of our favorite sponsors. Well, I don't know if it's one of our favorite sponsors. It's one of my favorite sponsors. It is Sunset Lake Sabade. It's sunsetlakesabade.com. Why do I say those last three letters in such a weird way? Because it's just a way to get around, different platforms' particularities. But if you use the code LEFTISBEST, you get 20% off. Let me tell you something. Over my two-week vacation, the longest vacation I have had, contiguous vacation I've had in 11 years, I indulged a little bit. This is like, you know, some people, you know, have their like 5 o'clock martini or whatever it is, or their 3 o'clock martini. Well, I hit the sour, the gummy bears and some of the fudge and some of the smokables. And then, of course, I used the tincture to go to sleep. And I started to dig into the melatonin tincture as well. They have, like I say, infused CBD coffee. They have tinctures with melatonin. They have fudge. They have gummy bears. They have smokables. They have keef. You can use it with smoking other stuff, or you can smoke it alone. It gives you a very sort of awesome sensation of relaxation, but there's nothing psychedelic about it. Their products have a tremendous amount of integrity, as do they as a company. They were the ones who first donated to the, not the first people, I think, but they were very early in donating to the Worcester Nurses Strike Fund. And that strike just ended, and the nurses prevailed. So they have great practices in terms of their product and great practices in terms of their company. They are movement partners, and that they chose the code left is best. You get 20% off sunsetlakesebede.com. Check it out. All right. I want to welcome to the program, Osita Wanevu. He is a contributing editor at The New Republic and author of the upcoming book, The Right People. Osita, great to have you come on. Appreciate you joining us.
Thanks for having me back on.
So your piece in The Times is about our broken electoral system. I don't know if that is also what your book is about. We can talk about that a little bit. Let me just read this one quote that stuck out for me that I thought was really... here we go. Here it is. I'm sorry. I've lost the quote. But let's talk about this piece. It's our institutions that have helped produce the violent outburst that we saw on January 6th by building a sense of entitlement to power within America's conservative minority. Will you explain what you mean by that?
Sure thing. So, I mean, the piece is really about, in the last year, a lot of people have said that January 6th should be understood as an attack on our institutions. And I think that's true to a substantial extent, obviously. It was a rejection of a legitimate election. The citadel of the American political system was physically attacked. I don't want to downplay that or trivialize that. What my piece is really about is the extent to which we can also understand January 6th as being the product of institutions. There's one obvious way in which that's true. Donald Trump was the president in the first place because in 2016, the Electoral College system put him into the White House over the will of the American electorate. He stayed in office because there are such high barriers to removing the president from office. But also, as you say,
Let me take you 1 second, because this also really struck me, because I've been talking about this probably 5 years, and it never really occurred to me. You wrote, the most important fact about the Trump era, and it's true, and when I read this, I was like, how did I never actually just sort of like this congeal in my mind? The most important fact about the Trump era, though, can be gleaned by simply examining his vote tallies and his approval ratings. At no point in his political career, not a single day, has Donald Trump enjoyed the support of the majority of the country he governed for 4 years. I feel like we talked about that around that, but never actually did that specific statement congeal. That there was never a single day where the majority of Americans actually supported Donald Trump. It's shocking.
Yeah, you know, that's derived from, obviously, the results of the 2016-2020 elections and the poll averages. So if you look at, like, the 538 average of his approval ratings throughout his presidency, he's always underwater. He has his high points when he's inaugurated, but it's not, like, over 50%, right? And he just stays underwater his entire presidency. And I think that's an important fact to understand. When you think about January 6th, because I think that what I was about to say was, I think that part of what happened on January 6th happened because conservative voters don't really understand that and haven't been encouraged to understand that by our political outcomes. So what I mean by that is that if you don't really know anything about the structure of the American political system and the biases at work, you're just sort of watching American politics as a casual observer. You see Bush come to the White House. You see Trump, after the Obama presidency, come to the White House. You see that even though Democrats, you know, have won elections, Republicans have retained an extraordinary amount of power in the United States Senate. You understand that Republicans and conservatives have managed to dominate the judiciary. if you aren't thinking actively about the structure of the American political system, I think there's a voter out there who says to themselves, well, all of this happens because America's a conservative country, right? The bulk of the American electorate must be conservative. If conservatives are winning this easily, and even when they lose, they're retaining this much power. That must be because the generic American voter out there is kind of a center-right to right-wing person. But you know, and I know, and people who've studied the American political system know, that's not actually the case. The conservatives prevail so often and retain so much power because the system was designed in such a way that the constituencies that the Republican Party is really strong with happen to be more powerful than the rest of the electorate, given the design of the Senate, the Electoral College, and so on. And when you do have Democratic victories, like Biden winning in 2020 or Obama winning, we understand that as Democrats managing to overcome increasingly long odds. I think that for the voter who understands the bulk of the American electorate as conservative, they instead tell themselves the story that, well, there must have been fraud afoot. Like something underhanded must have happened in order for the rightful American majority to have been defeated in this way. And they start reaching for these other kinds of explanations, whether that's importing a new electorate through immigration or, you know, voter fraud in American cities. Like they start telling themselves these stories to explain why the bulk of the American public, as they understand it, is lost. And I think that's part of what drove people to do what they did on January 6th, the sense that the left has cheated what they understand is a conservative country away from its rightful place in power in the American political system.
And we'll talk about sort of the other forces that helped sort of, I guess, as a catalyst for that. But this idea, you also write, and this is also, Republicans in the Senate haven't represented a majority of Americans since the 1990s, yet they've controlled the chamber for half of the past 20 years. I mean, that's, I mean, you know, like, and of course, you know, we've talked about this quite a bit. And you write, in 2012, the party managed to take control of the House, even though Democrats won more votes. We talk about this. We talk about Wisconsin, where Democrats can win 53% of the vote in the state elections, and that garners them only 35% representation in the state House. We talk about that as an injustice, but we never talk about what it does to the mentality of people who just assume that, like, well, I mean, who don't know those details. And, you know, as much as we talk about them here, I mean, you laid them out in a very sort of stark way. And it creates this sort of mass delusion, I guess, amongst people. And why? What happens, do you think, like, with that lack of sort of humility of losing an election? Do you know what I'm saying? We see one end of the delusion, which is, oh, we must be a conservative country. That's why, we win so much and control so much. Is it just the absence of that humility, or what? It creates this delusion, I guess, amongst a certain number of people. And of course, it's promoted by the entire Republican Party.
Right. So I think there are two other effects worth thinking about. One is political extremism, right? So if it's easier for conservatives to win elections and to stay in power, that means that there are fewer consequences for using kind of extreme and inflammatory rhetoric, right, on the right than there are on the left, because you're not having to appeal to as many people and you're not having to, appeal to sort of more liberal voters and in the way that the system is designed and set up. So, you know, somebody like Donald Trump and his functionaries in the House and the Senate, they have an easier time getting away with saying crazy stuff than, you know, the equivalent politician on the Democratic side would. And that's something I think that leads to more extreme outcomes. You have these people who are just sort of flamethrowers being elected to Congress and just sort of staying there because it's just easier for them to stay there. So that's one consequence. The other thing, too, is that one of the things that you hope happens in a functioning democracy is that there is sort of even give and take between the sides that are contesting power, right? So we have a system which it is taken entirely for granted that if Democrats want to win and keep control of the Senate, or if they want to win the presidency, they're always having to think to themselves, okay, how can we make this or that policy, or this or that message appeal to this moderate to conservative white voter out there in the middle of the country, right? And so we have all these conversations, this popularism debate we've been having over the last several months is a reflection of that. We have all of these debates about how a Democratic policy agenda can be constrained to fit those political parameters, right? Republicans never, ever have to say to themselves, well, how can we make this policy agenda more appealing to somebody who's living in an apartment complex in New York City or in Los Angeles or why I live in Baltimore, right? How can we make this social policy appeal to somebody who's just sort of like a young liberal or progressive person? How can we moderate or temper our rhetoric to meet that person? Because that person also matters in the electorate. That's not a conversation we have in our politics ever. And so that creates, I think, a real unevenness in the extent to which both sides have agency and control over the policy agenda that they put forward to people. You have one side that is always having to constrain, confine, reduce their ambitions. And another side that doesn't have to as much, just because, again, they have an easier time winning elections. And even when they lose elections, as we see now, Democrats nominally have control over the Senate and nominally have control over the House. But Republicans still retain enough power, given the design of the system, that they're functionally filibustering the whole agenda. And they have to, Democrats have to figure out what to do about that, right? That's something that distorts our political outcomes and distorts even our sense of what we can propose on the left and on the progressive side. If you had a healthier democratic system, that wouldn't be the case as much, I don't think.
I want to go back over the first consequence and then come back to that second consequence in terms of, like, you know, what we can do about it. But that first one, in terms of the extreme rhetoric and how it promotes that they, because they don't have to get a fair or a broader based amount of support, and because the Republicans are so homogenous in many respects in terms of, like, who they represent, you know, there was people were sort of amazed at, like, they didn't show up yesterday. I mean, we just played that clip of Ted Cruz, you know, bemoaning the fact that there were some terrorists who attacked some police officers who were protecting them. And then, of course, within 24 hours, he's apologizing for saying that on Tucker Carlson. But none of the Republicans showed up at that ceremony yesterday, except for Dick Cheney, which I want to just get to, because that to me strikes, you know, I think maybe fits in the second consequence. But they don't need to show up at that because of that very reason, right? I mean, they don't need to do any of the performative things that, you know, one would expect an American politician has to do because of the nature of the American electorate. They don't have to do that because they can win with 45%, maybe less, and never have to get above 50%. I mean, 40 million more people voted for the Democratic 50 senators than the Republican 50 senators. It really is stunning.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that the reaction to January 6th, you're right, is exemplifies that divide. The fact that you have Ted Cruz having to grovel to Tucker Carlson, I'm sorry I called this person who attacked a cop, you know, a bad word and a bad name. You know, that's reflective of exactly that. Ted Cruz is beholden not to, you know, the broad public. He doesn't have to appeal to somebody like me or somebody who lives in the city that I live. And he has to appeal to the kinds of people who watch Tucker Carlson, you know. And that's something that, as I said before, is only going to coarsen and radicalize the kind of rhetoric we see coming out of the right. And it's something that's going to lead to more political violence. One of the things I say in the piece too, I can't remember exactly how I put it, but I think it's something like January 6th was not the first or the deadliest attack caused by this mentality that I'm talking about. The thing that I was referring to there is actually the Pittsburgh shooting, which, you know, as bad and as terrible as January 6th was, that shooting really sticks out in my mind as maybe the lowest point in the Trump presidency. And to my mind, it was a different kind of attack. It was a different kind of event, but it was also triggered by the same kinds of anxieties, right? You had somebody who had heard a lot of conservative rhetoric about migrant caravans and Democrats usurping the conservative polity. and decided to take it into their own hands to sort of kill people who he thought were sort of behind all of this, right? But that's reflective of the same anxiety that I'm talking about, the sense that on the left or in the Democratic Party, there are people who are working to undermine power for the sort of great bulk, conservative bulk of the country who really deserve it and who really constitutes what America really is. That leads, I think, not only to attacks on politicians and the political system, like we saw on January 6th, but also, as we saw in Pittsburgh and we've seen in other cases, it's something that probably is a recipe for violence in all kinds of aspects of American life. There are books coming out now. People are talking about, you know, is there going to be like another American Civil War? I wouldn't put it that way. That's not really what I think. But I do think that there have been points in American history where we've seen a lot of low-level political violence. You can think about the late 1960s and early 1970s. You can think really about, you know, sort of the antebellum period of American history. That's just sort of part of our history as a country. And I think we could be moving to a place where, because we have all of these distorted, or the right has all of these distorted ideas about what America really is and who really matters, you know, I think they're going to take more and more radical action to cement power from their perspective and to sort of protect themselves from what they perceive as cultural threats. I think that's very troubling and something that's exacerbated by extreme rhetoric coming from politicians who don't have to appeal to a broad electorate.
How much, I mean, you know, when you say they feel they're under attack by cultural threats, there is a conservative mentality that I think is about is really founded in grievance. And I think it is exacerbated by the fact that, issues of the emancipatory movements that came out of the 60s for black people, for women, for LGBTQ. I mean, we've talked about this, you know, through the Trump years, the idea that, you know, like when I was a kid, I watched TV and everything I watched, whether it was the commercials or the shows, was essentially for me as a white kid, either I was centered as a kid, or I was centered as to who I will be when I grow older. You know, like it was all about me. And then I grow older, and all of a sudden, it's like, wait a second, my mom or my sister is in the center of this TV show, or you know, I'm not the guy getting the Cialis in the ad. It's a black guy getting the Cialis. Like I'm no longer, you know, like there is a loss. My loss of privilege on some level, or my loss in terms of being centered in everything, dovetails with this sense that there's no way the Barack Obama could be elected or Joe Biden could be elected because, you know, we have this control. Like, is that a coincidence? Like the fact that, I mean, it dovetails so nicely that essentially the party of mainly white people, vast majority, I know that's not even a relatively controversial statement, is still able to win with less votes across the board in many, many arenas. Right. And when that doesn't happen, they feel aggrieved, which also dovetails with this sort of like cultural aggrievement. And it's on one hand a coincidence. On another hand, it is like, was it just sort of like dumb luck that they stumbled upon this, or how does that relationship happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are related. I don't think there's a coincidence that over the last year and a half, especially, you've had a lot of conversation on the right about quote unquote woke capital, right? The sense that the major corporations are trying to ram certain cultural ideas down the throats of conservative people. You know, they see things like companies making statements after George Floyd's killing, you know, in support of Black Lives Matter, and they say, "Well, this is a conspiracy to make Black Lives Matter a thing," you know, that's being done by underhanded wealthy people. So I think what's going on there is that there's this basic mismatch, right? If you're like the Coca-Cola Corporation, or you are like Apple or something, or you're like Google or something, the way that you make money is to have as broad a consumer base as possible, right? So you really do want to have both the guy out there in Kansas and the guy in New York City you know, as your customers, right? You want an as expansive a market as you possibly can, right? And so to appeal to the bulk of the country, those companies have made this calculus that, like, actually, most of the consumers out there are people who are kind of like favorable to or sympathetic to Black Lives Matter. So we're going to put out this press release that says that we're for it too. But again, if you're conservative, who has this understanding of the country that, like, oh, well, actually, mostly people are conservative. That's why we have these political outcomes that we have. You see that, again, as a kind of underhanded conspiracy that has to be explained away with these crazy theories. And I think that's another reflection of this mentality that I'm talking about. If you see that most of the country is conservative, you also then begin to explain these cultural shifts and what corporations are doing in terms of liberals exerting their power in underhand ways. Now, I happen to think that the Coca-Cola Corporation does not really give that much of a damn about Black
people care.
Or ordinary people. Now, again, this is a play for markets. This is about money. You know, a lot of companies will say those things and donate to Republican politicians who are suppressing the right to vote and doing all this stuff, you know.
It's not George Soros pulling the strings, and it is just simply, this is our branding right now.
It is the fact that, unlike within the American political system, to make money as a major corporation, you really do have to appeal to a broad consumer base, right? Corporations are doing that. Politicians are not doing that because they have different incentives. And so conservatives are trying to make sense of that divide in increasingly crazy ways, if that makes sense to you. They have this conspiratorial mentality that explains how both of those two things can coexist, a political system where they get their way, the culture where they're not getting their way. And they're sort of unifying those two ideas under the assumption that when liberals prevail, either in politics or in culture, there is some kind of conspiracy happening behind the scenes that they have to investigate and interrogate.
Let's talk about, you know, the second consequence that you had, you know, when the Democrats have some type of power, they've got to play to, you know, they're not their voters. And this is echoed in the media in many respects. We saw it in the notion of, like, how many times the New York Times went to, you know, any particular diner to interview ostensibly a swing voter who ended up being a Republican operative or something to that effect. But how much of also is it, like, you know, I mean, I think we saw this when Biden insisted upon letting the Republicans come in to negotiate the Build Back Better. And then when that didn't work out, sort of blessed the Portman cinema thing, as opposed to just sort of saying, like, we're going forward with this. If you guys have a proposal, put it on the table now, but I'm not going to sit around and wait 3 months for you to do this. And instead they did that. And we're at where we are today. But also, like, why is Dick Cheney there yesterday? Like, honestly, like Dick Cheney is a war criminal. Like, how do you communicate to the American public that there is a problem with the Republican Party when you allow the worst example of the Republican Party to show up on this day where you're trying to argue that, like, you want to talk about threat to democracy? Every principle, like thought out plan that was a threat to democracy literally came from Dick Cheney over the course of his 40-year career in the executive branch.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think so. And Democrats are hard. I mean, I think that on some level, for a lot of people, the trying to appeal to the moderate to conservative sort of white voter out there in the middle of the country, I think for a lot of people, that is genuinely something they see as a matter of political necessity and a matter of political strategy. But I also think that there are people who sort of normatively believe that that's how American politics should work, just sort of in principle, detached from questions of political strategy. I think that there are people who have internalized the sense that the way that the Senate works and the way the Electoral College works is actually kind of fair. And, you know, it was what was intended by the founders. And so if we have to, as a consequence of this, appeal to Republicans, that's okay, because in principle, apart from this question of political strategy, that is how a functioning republic should work. I think Joe Biden is one of those people, right? So Joe Biden now is entering into these conversations about, well, you know, maybe we should move to a talking filibuster and blah, 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 because he's having so much trouble getting his agenda through. But Joe Biden doesn't have a problem with, like, equal portion in the Senate. He said he doesn't really think the Electoral College is that big of a deal, right? He's somebody who I think believes these institutions are fundamentally kind of fair and just. And I think that's you know, it doesn't sound like, but that is ultimately the explanation of why Dick Cheney is there, right? You have all of these background reasons why I think a lot of Democratic elites have been given to a conception of politics where you really do actually have to, not just because it's strategically important, just because it's the right thing to do, find willing partners on the other side to bring in and to sort of valorize and to make compromises and deals with. And, you know, if Dick Cheney happens to put out a press release on January 6th saying, you know, attacking the Capitol is bad, well, he's now somebody that you have to bring into the coalition and praise for doing sort of the lowest common denominator thing. I'd be remiss too if I didn't also say that I think that money is part of this too. So I think that one of the reasons why you have Democrats who like the Senate and the way it's set up and like the Electoral College and the way they set it up, because they're just sort of economic moderate to conservatives. And they understand that the way the system is designed constrains progressive policymaking, right? It's hard to do Medicare for all, and it's hard to implement, you know, large-scale climate policy, and it's hard to bring power from the corporations back to the people if you have to go through all of these hurdles. And they happen to think that the existence of those hurdles is good for that reason, right? So that's the nexus of three things that I think are work with the Democratic Party: the strategic concerns, the concerns about principle, and then just the extent to which the design of the system has been very good for a lot of donors and corporations that the Democratic Party relies on, and that certain people in the Democratic Party think it's their job to serve.
Right. That third being sort of like the Joe Manchin, right? It's a figure.
Exactly. That kind of thing.
Yeah. He doesn't really give a crap about the, you know, historical institute. And the guy, right, just like whatever he can grab for that will cover his you know, you know, I'm trying to come up with some metaphor for him, why you would use a fig leaf, but it's really just sort of his corporate largesse, as it were. Let's talk about the first one, though, the strategy. Has that, like, what's it going to take to get rid of that? I mean, because, like, you know, there are people who, like, over the past 4 or 5 years were, like, venerating, you know, God, I can't even remember his name. The Axis of Evil speechwriter. I can't from. Yeah. And just sort of like all these, like, these political commentators or the Lincoln Project or this and that, like, because theoretically from a strategic standpoint, this is the way that we defeat Donald Trump. And there's really no evidence of that. I mean, maybe they can go off if David Frum wants to go and find a constituency and get them to vote against Donald Trump, you know, go with God. But does he need to be platformed and venerated by Democrats? Just from a strategic standpoint, just that doesn't, are we there yet where, like, Democrats who are, to the extent that there are any Democrats who are, you know, genuinely like, I just did this cynically out of strategy, where they realize, like, this is not a strategy to win anymore. I mean, like, when do we start to see these two, the third cohort, like the Manchins, they're always going to do this, and for as long as they could. In the second cohort, like, you know, like Russ Feingold strikes me as that type of guy, if he was still a politician, because he was such an institutionalist. But I think, like, he's seen, you know, and maybe Biden is one of those too, although, you know, who knows. But I think there's, like, strategy in those institutionalist things, sort of they meld at different points. There's a little bit of a crossover. They're not mutually exclusive. But like, are we close, do you think, to, or is this something we're just going to have to wait for, like, a couple of generations to die off of the Democratic leadership?
I've kind of started thinking it's the latter thing, honestly. I mean, I think that the popularism debate of the last few months is really, it surprised me that nobody understands that this is fundamental what Democrats have always done. You know, I wrote a piece about this in, I think, October or November. Like the populism debate.
You define populism debate.
Sure. So the populism debate is there are some commentators now who have made the argument that if Democrats really want to keep control of Congress in November, if they want to win in 2024, what they have to do is what we talked about at the very beginning. Like they have to temper and moderate their agenda in order to appeal to this sort of moderate to conservative white voter who happens to, you know, be the key to controlling the Senate in these swing contested states, right? And winning the Electoral College. And the thing that's it's weird about it is that it's a debate that's presented as though, like, Bernie Sanders won the Democratic nomination. He's president now, and he's doing all of these, like, great sort of progressive things that you like and I like. No, like, Joe Biden's the president. He was the moderate choice
right
in that election. He is pursuing, you know, a fairly moderate agenda. He's not, he's talking about how we need to give more money to the police and he's not doing the things that I want to do on immigration, you know. And so to a large extent, Biden is doing the populist agenda without that actually paying real political dividends that we've seen. I mean, his approval ratings are really, really bad right now. But also beyond that, something you said before it was pretty important. Like it's not a strategy that you can continue to believe is going to work the way that it once might have, right? So in 2006, Democrats managed to take control of the House again because they run, you know, generally like they run some moderate candidates who say the Iraq War is bad and people don't like Bush, you know. And by the time Obama gets in, he has control of Congress, right? And that majority, especially in the Senate, is built partially on, you know, fairly moderate to conservative Democrats. The issue is that once that happens, you then have a Democratic majority that isn't actually capable of passing a real Democratic agenda, because the people you relied on to win were these sort of moderate people who oppose half the things that you want to do anyway. And by the way, next time you have a midterm election, they're going to be sort of out-moderated, out-conservative by the Republican candidate, you know? And that's why Obama lost control of Congress gradually, first in 2010, you know, and then the Senate afterwards. So this is a strategy that we've seen work to some extent, but not work to a substantive extent, in that it hasn't actually allowed Democrats to pass and sustain a real agenda. And then the strategic long term, it's something that ends up failing anyway. Bill Clinton, you know, is seen as this guy who managed to appear conservative, moderate to the electorate, and win all of these white working class voters. And that's legitimately true. He did do that. He also lost Congress, right?
Yes.
And people don't tell that story.
Time in, what was it, 40 years, 35 years up to that point? Like, the Democrats had held Congress, the House, for decades at that point. Right. And we should also say Obama did the exact same thing. Obama left office very popular, and the Democratic Party was decimated across the country. And I would also add, in 2006, people forget a big reason why they won with those moderates was because the Republican leadership was basically caught protecting a guy who was perceived as a child predator, and Mark Foley. And you know, that I think that is underestimated in terms of what it did to the electorate. And so the point being that, I mean, I would say what you're describing to me was always how I would describe the Red Sox until 2004, that they always built their teams to just barely make the playoffs so that Red Sox fans wouldn't, you know, get too demoralized, but right. Never to win the World Series. And that's sort of like where we're at with the Democrats at this point. They just, and then the question becomes, is that by, how much is that by design? Like, how much is that a function of one of those three cohorts that you described?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on who you're talking about within the party. I mean, I think that all of those motivations and all of those factors sort of combine and tangle themselves in difficult ways or in complicated ways. But, you know, I think that for a lot of people, there is you know, genuinely like a hope that you can use the Democratic majority to pass good things, but also a cluelessness about what we've been talking about, the extent to which this strategy is not a durable long-term strategy. And the actual thing you would want to do if you wanted to build Democratic power is try to not just appeal to this moderate conservative white voter who's sort of out there already electorate, but actually reach out to disengaged people and other people who might be converted and encouraged to think, you know, in more left-wing ways about public policy. And that's a more difficult thing to do and a costlier thing to do and a more time-intensive thing to do than it is to say, well, there are all of these swing voters who are just sort of going to show up naturally in an election and we're just going to spend 3 months out of an election year making ads for those people. And that's how we're sort of eke out a majority, right? That's the easy thing. The harder thing to do is, and I think I've talked about this when, you know, in the previous appearance here, the harder thing to do is to do what the conservative movement did in the 60s and 70s, which is say to themselves, look, like most people in this country are not as conservative as we'd want them to be. People actually feel pretty good about government and what it's capable of doing. And so if we actually want to win political power, we have to get out there and actually change people's minds and to build a conservative electorate. It's going to take a long time and it's going to take a lot of money. But if we make that investment a decade from now, decade and a half from now, we could be in a position of more political power than we are now. And that's what they did. You know, Barry Goldwater is demolished in 1964. Ronald Reagan is elected in 1980. In between those two elections, they did what it took to build a real movement in this country. And it wasn't just about making ads in a given campaign. It was about building out political infrastructure, right, that would sustain them for a long term. And those organizations still exist, many of them today, and are still influencing our politics today, right? So I think that if you're on the left, or if you consider yourself a progressive, that's the task that you have to basically take on as a project. I don't really have very much faith that the Democratic Party as an institution is going to be doing that work. I think that for the reasons we described, they're committed to, you know, politics as we've experienced them over the last several years. I don't see them really deviating from that strategy. But you have to hope that independent political organizations and organizing on the left is capable of doing that infrastructural work, even if the major party you would hope to have on our side isn't going to do it. You know, I don't know if we're actually going to do it. I think we're capable, but that's what you have to hope for.
It's funny. Yesterday, I interviewed Adam Hilton, who has written a book about the Democrats and the sort of hollowing out of the party infrastructure, really since the early 70s, where they're in contrast to the Republican Party, which had built up an infrastructure and then ultimately married it with this conservative Christian movement. And that's what ended up being their recipe for success. There is no apparatus for the Democratic Party at this point. Unions went away, and there was no sense during that long run in which Democrats were winning in Congress in the House seats that they needed to build any type of like infrastructure on the ground. I don't know if it's DSA or some other sort of like surrogate organizations that would build this, but that's where we're at. And I think your piece really placed January 6th in a very enlightening way. I really appreciate it. And Sita, I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it. Hope to see you more soon now that you're done with that book.
I've just started it, actually. What? That book is in its early stages. Yeah,
it is.
But at some point, I'll be happy to come on and talk about it. Okay. Absolutely.
Right. Well, we look forward to it. Thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Oh, and check out, you have a newsletter as well, right?
That's right. And I think you can probably just link to it somewhere.
All right. We will link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much again, Asita.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, folks. Is she here already? I thought we were going to have time to chit-chat, but no. Dame Judy Gold. Wait, who am I thinking of? Like that refers to that. Is here?
Of Judy Dench, I think.
Dench. Judi Dench. But wait, don't we have some music?
I don't know. I didn't equip Bradley for the guest panel.
What?
Oh my god. What's going on, Judy? Is somebody vacuuming where you live?
No, because of my hair. Let me tell you something. This hair, I was going to fix my hair, and I said, no, this hair represents how I fucking feel.
Now, wait a second. I'm not talking about your hair. I'm talking about... Like, what are you, maybe...
Oh, she put on the fucking...
God damn it.
I'll be right there. She put on the fucking dishwasher.
Ooh, I like that. It's very domestic.
Yeah, yeah.
God damn it. You know those ladies... You know, the wife, you know, doesn't realize I have a
fucking career here. She's putting on the dishwasher.
All right, we got it. We may need volume coming in a little bit now that the...
Now that the dishwasher, fuck.
I'm telling you,
these women...
Yeah, I know. I mean, tell me about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
First of all, Happy New Year. Let me tell you something. What a Happy New Year it is. And, you know, my partner, my lover, Elisa, turned 60, so I have to find on New Year's Eve, and I need, so now she's way too old for me, so I have to, yeah.
New Year's Eve?
Her birthday's New Year's Eve.
Holy crap. Did that put a lot of pressure on things?
Well, I hate New Year's Eve. I think it's the stupidest fucking holiday. It's like...
Amateur hour.
It's ridiculous. And you remember doing stand-up on New Year's Eve? It was like... Yeah, with the fucking screaming and it was just like, why am I? And it was the money was so good, you had to do it, and that should have been the harbinger of things to come. New Year, doing stand up on New Year's Eve.
What do you mean?
Those people who would attend the shows on New Year's Eve are now running the fucking country. Those people who sat there screaming. Like, would pay extra money to see a comedian and not listen because in 24 minutes, it's going to be midnight. That's who's running this country right now. So there's that. So there's New Year's. There's and I don't, you know what? As a Jew, I kind of feel like Rosh Hashanah is the real New Year.
Yeah.
Because, well, you know, it's in the fall. That's when school starts. You know, it's like new beginnings. And then... January, it sucks so fucking much. Like, everything about January, like, build up, holidays, build up, and then just shit. The weather sucks. Everyone's depressed. Now, fucking, I can't take anymore. Like, we had an anniversary of January 6th. Like, am I living in another reality than these fucking people?
Well, we be more specific. Are you saying that, like, why are we having an anniversary of January?
No, that they don't even fucking show up, these motherfuckers. They don't even acknowledge it.
It's a little bit odd. It's a little bit odd that the Republican Party didn't feel like they needed to sort of recognize that there was...
But everyone except for Liz Cheney, who I used to Dick, not a fan. No. Not a fan of Liz. But
we can still hate Lynn Cheney.
No, Liz.
We can still hate both Cheneys.
Okay. Here's the problem. I have respect for her, you know. I feel like she is the only, well, I guess, it, well, forget it. Now I just take that whole thing back.
I mean, look. Am I glad that there is some Republicans that can be used to leverage to make other Republicans seem unreasonable? Yes. Am I going to give her credit for just her branding, for her deciding that her brand is better suited one way than another, and she made a bad bet? And if she could, there's no doubt in my mind, if she could have seen into the future, and realized that she was going to be alienated from the party, that she would have chosen the other way. But she had to go down this road that she couldn't reverse. And so this is where she's placed her bet. But she doesn't get my respect for that. She's still a piece of garbage. And so is her father. And I would
her father. First of all, why he has that for, it's COVID. Okay. He has a fake heart. He never had a heart, but now he has a fake. How do these people survive like this?
You know it. Of all the people who should have passed away.
What about, like, how Trump drinks, I can't even say, Diet Coke, eats shit. Like, how, if I did this, I would be massive heart attack, massive stroke.
I don't know. It's okay. It's unjust. It is. Patently unjust. So how are you dealing with this Omicron thing? Are you just basically...
It's so great. It's so great, Sam. First of all, I want you to know how hot you look with the beard. Okay?
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yes. I mean, you're growing into, you know, some people they age and, you know, you're like, oh, he used to be good looking. It's just working for you. I just want to tell you that. Now, as a lesbian. Now, Omicron, I just want you to know, one of my kids has had COVID three fucking times.
What?
His girlfriend has had it three fucking times. My other son's girlfriend's had it twice.
I didn't know you could do that, that you could get it three times.
Well,
twice. I've never heard of people getting it three.
Yes. Yes. So, and I got to tell you, I was
post-vaccination, or like, were they vaccinated? Obviously they were vaccinated, but like,
well, one was right in like 2020 early. Okay. Then like March of 2020. So that was the first thing before anything. Then in August, I guess it was, or September of 2020-ish, I think.
Right.
They both got it September, October, and then they just got it again, this Omicron, whatever. No one knows how to fucking say it.
Wild type probably twice, but no Delta and one Omicron. Like, that's pretty good that you can hit variant.
And, yes, and, but that, you know, by the time they were boosted, except for Ben. My younger son wasn't boosted. He caught it. He had two shots, not three. And now he can't get the third because he got the, you know, he has to wait 3 months. But all the other ones were boosted.
Wow.
I can't. And I was with them in the apartment, and I didn't get it.
Why is that?
I'm an Eastern European stock.
Your kids aren't?
Yeah, that was very funny, Sam. I like the way you took it. I don't know. I have a really good immune system, but I'm also really careful, but it doesn't matter because everyone's really careful. But I can't believe I did a show on Christmas Eve. I wore a mask except on the stage. I didn't get it. I don't know why I'm tempting fate right here. What the fuck am I doing? Shut up, Judy.
Are you canceled any shows since then or what?
I'm in Provincetown. I came up here. I was like, you know, we came up for Elisa's birthday. Elisa, who's very attracted to you. We just stayed. Why I'm going to go back tomorrow to New York, but it's like, how is New York? It's like everything's closed, right? I don't want to go out to dinner. I don't want to.
I'm not going to dinner. No, it's sort of not. I mean, I don't really have a full sense of what it is because all I do is I walk between here, my apartment and home, and then I just deal with my kids who are freaking out because my son's teacher is out with COVID. She's been out since the beginning of the year. My son's principal is out with COVID.
Wow.
He's out with COVID. More than half the kids in the class aren't even showing up. My daughter is like, I'm not going into school today because half the kids don't wear masks.
Really?
Well, there's a, I mean, this is her perspective. I don't know. Generalize, but there's a lot of Russian students in her class that she said they won't. They don't wear masks for whatever reason. I don't know.
Where is she going to school? Fucking Putin University? Where is this?
Oh, she goes to school in a high school in Brooklyn, and it's a big school, 4,000 students. A lot of teachers are out, and so...
Wow. Yeah. Okay, here's the thing. I feel bad for the kids. I have a son who's in college. You know, his games have been canceled. He plays basketball. His games have been canceled and canceled and canceled. Postponed. Four kids on the team tested positive. I was going there this weekend to go. They don't allow spectators, and now the games are canceled. Okay, I did go to two broad. First of all, we were in Aruba when Omicron hit. We wore double masked on that fucking plane home. And, you know, really careful. And then we come to New York and it's a fucking shit show. And I don't even want to take the subway anymore. It's just like, I can't take it anymore. But isn't this how the 1918 pandemic ended? That there was a less virile,
I mean, it's possible. It's not inconceivable. That's the case. Your kids have gotten it three times. And there's no reason why we can't get it 10 times.
Right. But I think, I don't know. It's just awful. It's just like, you think you're moving forward and then it's like, no, wait a minute. And then when I went to Broadway shows, they are so strict. They are so beyond strict.
Broadway show.
I went in December. I went to see the Lehman Trilogy, which was fucking amazing. And Carolina Change, fucking amazing. And I literally, if you take your mask like and go like that, they come down with a flashlight, put your mask on. You have to be boosted. They check everything.
I was supposed to take my kids to a little Shop of Horrors, and then the night before it got canceled because too many people had COVID.
COVID, yeah.
Yes.
You got to go to one-person shows, Sam. That's the only, yeah.
My 8-year-old son is not a big
fan. I know, I'm kidding.
Of one-person.
Okay, Sam. Here's the deal. I can't take this shit show anymore. We're on year two. Year two.
What are you going to do about it?
Sam, what? I have no power. I'm a fucking lesbian in my late 50s, like the latest of the 50s that you can be in.
Okay, fair enough.
A Jew, everyone hates us.
Right, right.
I live in a country where people, you know, I did hear Adam Schiff say this, he said, you know, you remember when you used to say on the playground, oh, yeah, I'll believe it when I see it? That doesn't apply anymore to people in our country. I'll believe it when I see it.
Are you noticing any change? Like, you haven't been touring, though, right? You've just been, like, performing sort of like...
No, I'm supposed to go to... I am going to Indianapolis or Carmel, Indiana on Saturday. Carmel, Indiana.
What? You're doing
Feinstein's. Yes, I'm Feinstein's at the Carmichael Hotel. Yes, I'm doing a show. I have kids. You know you have to make money. I don't have some fucking great, I got my majority report. I'm the host. And then I get to walk two blocks to my fucking studio. I got my whole posse here. I don't have that shit, Sam. I'm not a white entitled male like you.
I mean, I wish I could argue with any of that except for the
right.
Two. It's actually like I walk over 30 minutes to work.
Oh, wow. Do you walk home?
Yeah.
Okay, so you get your steps in. Big fucking deal.
Yeah, I get my steps in. So wait a second. So where are you playing in Indiana? Is it a...
It's Feinstein's at the Hotel Carmichael.
Okay.
And it's a cabaret room. It's small, and I'm very... And I hope, and hopefully everyone will sneeze on me and it'll be, yeah.
What are the requirements you have? Like, do you say like, I'm not doing a show unless everybody's vaxxed?
Yes, vaxxed. And yes, I do. Okay. And I did it in Florida too. When I was in Florida in November, that I made sure, you know, and Ron, I love Ron DeSantis, by the way. Just fucking great guy. He, you know, if you require a vax and mask and proof of vax or booster, whatever, he can shut down your show.
Has anybody had a show shut down from that?
I think people have said that they're not doing their show. I can't with this hair. But people have said they're not doing their show or, yes, have canceled the shows. Yes.
It would be fun to have the police come and shut your show down because you're requiring a vaccine.
Right. Like, but that only happens to, you know, like if that happened to me, I could get some fucking mileage out of that. But no.
Yeah, no. That's what I'm saying. Like, I'm almost inspired to do a live show in Florida just to require a vaccine and masks.
Right. But I did on my show, and it worked.
And it worked. They said they didn't.
Yeah. Well, no one's like, oh, you know, no one in the fucking Florida government was like, you know, let's shut down Judy Gold's show. That'll be really an impactful thing to do.
Did you think that maybe what you should do? I mean, this is what I would probably do, is call up the Florida Attorney General's office and say, hey, this Sam Cedar guy is coming down here and doing a show and requiring vaccines and masks. You got to do something about this.
Okay, Sam, I don't think like you, okay? Uh-huh. No, I wasn't thinking that. But now you're going to fucking steal this idea and get all this press.
I mean, that's probably what, I mean, that, maybe that's the way that, like...
But you know what, Sam? You can't walk to Florida, okay?
I've been thinking about, like, you know, I got the kids go on vacation in February, and I want to take them to someplace warm so they can, like, walk around outside.
Right.
Thinking about going to Florida. I'm hoping by February, maybe, like, the Omicron thing will have, like, peaked and started to drop down. Maybe I could tie in, like, a fake show.
That's great, Sam. I think that's a really good idea. And you know what? Your kids, when you go on vacation, love it when the parents work. They love that.
Well, I wouldn't actually have to do the show. I would just...
Right, you would just pretend that you were having a show. Like, say you didn't have a publicist, and then you would call and make believe you're your own publicist.
Yeah, I would say, like, this is, what is it, Jim Miller?
Wait, who was Trump's publicist that he faked he was? Was it Jim Miller?
What, Matt, do you remember what it was?
John Mayer.
Oh, John Barrett.
John Barrett. So you call up and say you're John Barrett. Hi, Matt!
Or was it John Barron, I think?
John Barron.
I just said hi, Matt, and he fucking ignores me. It's like my kids.
Hey, Judy.
We just got an IM from Flairchild that said, Judy Gold's kid getting COVID like it's a new iPhone.
That is hilarious. You know what? I need to. Can that person write for me?
I was going to say, that's actually a pretty good.
Pretty funny.
If anybody goes and sees Judy at the Hotel Carmichael, you may see her deliver that joke.
Hey, now. And I'm not giving you credit. Sam, when am I going to be out of this fucking, like, I really thought once Fuckface was out, right, I would go back to some sort of normalcy. But it's, when is this fucking, are we going to have a civil war? What the fuck is going on?
No, I don't think we're going to have a civil war, but I think it's going to be fucked up for a while. So
don't you think the Democrats are going to come out and vote? Because they can't fucking deal with these motherfuckers, even though they're gerrymandering?
I don't know. I mean, I'm a little bit too close to these things to sort of get a sense of, like, what the average voter is thinking. I feel like a lot of people have sort of checked out of politics for the time being.
Yes, I agree. Because it's too fucking much. But that fucking... Or here's the other thing I wanted to say.
Yeah.
You know when Biden was on the phone call and the fucking asshole is talking to him and says, let's go, Brandon, at the end?
Yeah.
Okay. So classy, by the way. Really classy. Really good role model for the kid. Like, fucking great guy. Anyway.
Well, Judy, wouldn't you, like, if you were on the phone with Donald Trump, would you even say, let's go, Brandon? The part that really seemed ridiculous to me was that the guy said, let's go, Brandon, as opposed to, like, fuck you, Biden. Why not just say, like, I mean, if you were on the phone with Donald Trump, wouldn't you take the opportunity to go, fuck you, Trump, you asshole?
Probably. Yeah. I don't know. Yes. I mean, I would do more than fuck you, you motherfucking lying, racist, fucking piece of shit, misogynistic, fucking criminal, sexual predator, fucking dumb piece of shit, horrible parent, fucking, all right, anyway, I mean, I would do, but here was the thing. So Don Jr., who is, I can't even, he's, you know, he's on his whatever, TikTok, fucking Instagram, saying, oh, he's so clueless, he doesn't even know what Let's Go Brandon is. And I'm like, right, because he doesn't live in a fucking, you know, the schoolyard of your fucking, you know, middle school calling people names. Like, I'm glad he does. Like, I fucking hate them. Oh, he's so clueless because he doesn't know some stupid bullshit fucking trashy fucking Let's Go Brandon crap. I fucking hate everyone.
He doesn't know the code for Q or whatever.
Right.
Q these days. How come we don't hear much about Q anymore?
I know. Where the fuck is Q? And Q, didn't Q say something about, like, hey, this Q stepped something back. It stepped back a little bit.
I'm sort of sad that we didn't that Q has gone away. Did you see that Hamilton thing? The January 6th Hamilton thing that they did?
No.
Did you see that? Did you guys see that? Bradley, did you see it?
What?
Oh, you did watch it yesterday?
Yeah.
It was yesterday?
Yeah, Nancy Pelosi introduced Lin-Manuel Miranda, and they sang a song from Hamilton for Jan 6.
Did they really?
Yeah. Wait. We have the video if you want to watch it again.
Okay, I need to watch that right now.
You may have seen the wrong thing. I'm thinking about something different. Well, let's watch this. I didn't.
Okay.
To begin the conversation, we're privileged to have a contribution from one of the great creative talents of our time, Lin-Manuel Miranda. May his beautiful words be an inspiration to us. Among the words he said and in the music, we'll make it right for you. If we lay a strong enough foundation, we'll pass it on to you and we'll give the world to you. Lin-Manuel and his father and the Hamilton singers, whom we'll hear from.
Hamilton singers!
All very honored to be asked to participate today. I call your attention to...
A new year brings hope for the future, new energy to face the tasks ahead of us, and a renewed promise to strengthen the foundations of our democracy. We are all stewards of the American experiment, working to pass down to our children and our grandchildren a more perfect union that treats all its citizens with fairness and equity. We should never take our rights and liberties for granted, and we must remain committed to finding a way forward together. That's what I wrote about in the song Dear Theodosia from Hamilton. I believe no challenge is worth abandoning our efforts to unite as Americans. We'll keep working, generation after generation, until we reach that someday.
What? And then they do a song? Wait, what?
Yeah, why did you cut it? They do a song. They do the whole song.
Okay, can we just stop for 1 second? If you're going to be on a video where the Speaker of the House is introducing you as some, like, artistic, bring the country together, arts aficionado, blah, like... You know, maybe not standing in front of your closet of your kid's bedroom and not. Maybe an outfit.
Okay, I got to admit, I thought, like, I saw something on Twitter that was like, that did the numbers about, that it was like a sort of a comedy thing, maybe. I guess maybe it was from the Tonight, you know, it was from like Seth Meyers' show or something, or I don't know where. And I thought that's what we were playing. I didn't realize they actually brought out. The Hamilton people to sing a song.
The Hamilton singers, Sam. Ladies and gentlemen, the Hamilton singers. It's like fucking, what's his name? Lawrence Welk. And ladies and gentlemen, today, We have the Hamilton Singers.
Doesn't that seem to like diminish stuff? Like, can you imagine, like, I don't know, them coming out and going like, we're going to commemorate Pearl Harbor with like the, you know,
yes,
cast of a chorus line are going to sing.
Right.
Like, seems ridiculous to me.
I love the arts. What the fuck was this shit? What? I mean, I love Broadway, and I love all of that, but like, this is what's wrong. Hi, we're going to make our point by bringing the Hamilton Singers. The Hamilton Singers.
It's insane.
I mean, think of all the people they could have gotten. Not that Lynn isn't an important force, blah, 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 blah. Okay. But think of all the, I mean, John Lewis is dead. You know, how about a veteran? How about someone who fought and put their life on the line and fought for our constitutional right? Like, how about that?
Yeah, I had no idea. I missed that entire thing. That is,
this is why they make fun of us.
Yeah, except for I'm not a fan of, like, I didn't, you know, I mean, I appreciated the musical.
Just yes.
My daughter was into it, but I'm not a fan of Hamilton himself, frankly.
Right.
Musical, for that matter. But nevertheless, like, even a musical I like, even if it was like, you know, Fiddler on the Roof.
Right.
I would feel uncomfortable if they were trying to prove the point of January 6th was...
Whose fucking idea was that?
Yeah, that's the question.
We're going to have Nancy Pelosi speak.
Yeah, because like, I think Lin-Manuel's a nerd, but like, he was asked, right? Like, Pelosi said he and his dad were honored to be asked to be part of this. His dad's like a State Department guy or something, as far as I know.
Right.
But like, they were honored to be asked. Like, they shouldn't have been asked. It's like, even like, when we have, let's have somebody perform like Richard II or something. Like, it's just bizarre.
Right. Right. I mean.
Or they could have done like the last scene from Succession's finale this year.
I didn't see it. I'm on episode 7. Shut the fuck up. I don't want to know.
Well, too bad, because Nancy play it tomorrow when they talk about.
Oh my God. I can't believe they fucking did that.
No, not good. Well, Judy, so you're
yes.
in Indiana, and then what?
Right.
Any other shows?
Then I'm just going to be depressed. I mean, I do, but they're going to be canceled. I'm looking I'm in New York.
Podcast?
Yeah. What?
Still doing the podcast?
Of course. That's nice. That's really nice.
I don't know. You're out of town.
I have a fucking microphone and podcast equipment.
I mean, your sound doesn't sound so great right now.
It doesn't? Matt, is my sound okay?
I have to edit.
It's a little bit on the hot end, but it's fine.
A little bit hot.
All right, let me do output, you fucking fuck.
All right.
External headphones. It's just me. You're just mean. I'm calling Lin-Manuel.
Yeah, have you ever interviewed Lin-Manuel?
No, I haven't. But I have met him, and he's very nice. And his wife went to MIT. This is what my mother would say. She's dead, but rest in peace. And his wife went to MIT. You know, my mother, anytime someone went to an Ivy League or a Stanford or whatever, MIT, whatever. And they went to Ivy League. Okay.
Well, folks can check out Kill Me Now. Like, when does that, what day does it come out?
It comes out on Tuesdays. I do long form interviews. There are two episodes each. Sam Seder, it was one of my victims. And it is a labor of love, because as we all know, no one makes any money from podcasts unless you're Joe Rogan and you're peddling, you know, misinformation. Yeah, and it's called Kill Me Now, because I want to kill myself all the time, even though you're not allowed to say that anymore. And, yeah, so I do that. And I'm on the TikTok now and the Instagram and the, yes, Sam. And, you know, I wrote a book. There it is. Yes, I can say that about free speech and comedians. And, you know, I do the stand up and I'm doing, you know, I'll be appearing in a lot of television shows this year. I actually had a very good year last year.
Oh, that's good. That's exciting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Judy, as always, a real pleasure to talk to you. I'm glad to see that things are going
well. Mildly okay, but here's the deal. I'm going to have the cast of Gypsy perform because I am Hungarian, and weren't the Gypsies?
I don't know.
I think we were treated. Yeah. Everything goes back to the Holocaust. Anyway, here's the deal. This fucking country is pathetic, and it's not, I mean, you have, I know you have to hang up, but you have young children. Aren't you fucking worried?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's great.
Judy Gold, ladies and gentlemen. Judy
Gold. I love you all.
Hi, Judy. Love you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And, gazai gazan. And if I were a rich man,
oh my God. Oh my God. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us in the free half of the program. We're going to head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, catch us live in Boston, May 15th. We may start announcing another date for another show. We're getting together with, like, we're trying to run some numbers and whatnot, but right now, Boston, go to Majority Live, get tickets to the Boston show. We had a couple of cancellations. People couldn't make it because it's obviously time where it's planting season if you're a farmer. But for other people, we're selling tickets. So you can go to you can go to Majority Live or MajorityReportLive.com, get tickets to that May 15th show in Boston. Also, our merch, shop.majorityreportradio.com and justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use that coupon code majority, get 10% off. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
On Left Reckoning on Wednesday night, check that out. I reviewed Atlas Shrugged and actually recommended Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead relative to Atlas Shrugged because it's the same psychopathic message in about a third of the time. Tried to save Aaron Rodgers from being more of an idiot. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
All right. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Can you breathe that?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the breaks to do that.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday! My birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on! To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.